Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show is Chris Walsh, who is managing editor of Marijuana Business Daily. And this is a publication which serves what turns out to be a rapidly growing industry across the country, and of course, particularly in those parts of the country where marijuana, to varying degrees, is legal. And nearly half the states of the country have legalized marijuana, at least to some extent. And because it is such a rapidly growing industry, it's important to understand sort of the nature of that growth. And for people who, for one reason or another, feel like they perhaps want to explore the possibility of being part of it, something like the Marijuana Business Daily is an intriguing resource to which they can turn to get some more information. They have just released the Marijuana Business Factbook 2016, which explores some of the specifics behind this industry and charts the nature of its really quite spectacular growth. Chris Walsh is managing editor, as I said, and we welcome you, Chris Walsh, to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Can I just ask if your interest in this topic predates the time that you have been part of the staff of Marijuana Business Daily?
Absolutely not, actually. I mean, aside from trying cannabis sometimes in college, you know, I'm in my late 30s now. I have a wife and a kid. I didn't really use it at all for, you know, 18 years or whatever. And then we started this company. And, you know, the reason they hired me to kind of launch the content side of this company, the editorial, the analysis, and the news, and I thought it was a fascinating industry. This was in 2011, and at one point in Denver, which is where I'm based, there were more medical marijuana dispensaries than Starbucks here.
Wow.
So at that time, 2011, that feels like eons ago in this industry, you know, I thought this was just a fascinating business that was emerging. So that's why I personally and the founders of this company got involved. It's not like we were, you know, closet potheads or anything like that. We saw this as an interesting business.
Absolutely. In the introduction to this new report that you've just published, you point out something that hadn't necessarily even dawned on me. You write at one point, in most industries, business owners and investors have access to a wealth of financial information, benchmark data, and in-depth market insight to help them make decisions, assess the competition, target new investments, and tackle new opportunities. That, you go on to say, is not the case with the cannabis industry. Explain how this industry is different and the kind of important information that in fact is not as readily available as it is in other industries.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we first started, we realized that there was this black hole in this industry. That there was no information available at all. You know, that, and as you mentioned, just kind of the standard information you have in any industry. Revenues, what's the size of the industry, the market, what is the user base, how many customers are there? What are the average revenues for a business, profit margin? All of that was just completely non-existent when we started. So we started publishing, doing the research and publishing the Marijuana Business Factbook to kind of go over all that information and put it together and research and provide that to the industry so that people can develop business plans and figure out where to invest and really understand this market and this industry. So that is. And there's the big problem is the federal government doesn't track it because marijuana is illegal. So, you know, they're not following any part of the industry, releasing numbers on employment or anything like that, like they would do for any other sector. And then you have states that have legalized. A lot of them barely keep track of any information. I mean, in California, the state can't even tell you how much in taxes it gets from the industry because it has no idea how many businesses are out there and doesn't track anything. In Colorado, on the other hand, they track things very, very closely. So it's really on a state-by-state basis, and you have this patchwork of information that's available. So we try to provide the industry with that kind of information.
I'm glad you used the word patchwork. I was about to use that same term in describing a map that I saw just earlier this morning as I prepared for this interview. I was really curious because actually the gentleman who booked this interview for me, he asked me to what extent marijuana was legal here in the state of Wisconsin, and I actually had absolutely no idea, nor did I really have all that good an idea of just sort of the process by which partial legalization has occurred in some states. So I sought out and fairly quickly found a map that was actually rather confusing. It's not part of your publication, but a map someplace else that sort of charts out again, it looks like a patchwork of the country and the different states and the different extents or different degrees to which marijuana is legal or illegal. Without going obviously into all the details, can you just summarize for our listeners sort of that complicated picture of the varying degrees of legalization of marijuana?
Sure. And I think if you're in a state that hasn't legalized, it still seems like this foreign area and kind of it's funny to talk about and think about, oh, marijuana. But when you look at the map, you realize that half the country has legalized medical marijuana, half, including the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. So that's one layer. And then you have several states have legalized recreational marijuana, which is basically anyone 21 and over with an ID can buy marijuana in the store. And that's currently the states that have legalized recreational are Colorado, Washington State, Oregon, Alaska, and again, Washington, D.C. at the city level. It's legal there to possess and consume, but not to sell it. So basically, those are the two main layers. And then you have another layer, which is called decriminalization. And that's basically when a state or city says, if you get caught with marijuana, it's not a serious offense. Maybe you get a $50 fine, or maybe we won't do anything. So those states that have decriminalized only, you can't actually sell it and grow it, but if they catch you with it, you're not going to, face serious consequences. So half the state has legalized medical, and a handful of states have legalized recreational, and those numbers on both sides will probably increase by the end of this year, because you could see a lot more states legalizing in the November elections.
The medicinal qualities of marijuana, I think, to some extent, are not even yet fully understood. But can you just give us a real brief sense of the kind of help that marijuana can give and what we know about why it gives that help or how it yields that kind of help to people, for instance, experiencing chemotherapy?
Sure. A lot of opponents of medical marijuana say, well, there's no scientific research that says this helps with anything. But there's a reason for that. It's because the government has banned it. Because marijuana is a federally illegal substance, the government has not let any research happen. It's almost like with the gun issue, how you can't do studies about the impact of guns on certain things because of the stigma for marijuana against it. So the government says, no, you can't even study this. We're not going to provide any funds. So there's no good research available. Where we get the information is from the patients, the million-plus patients in the country that use medical marijuana now. And it seems to be particularly effective for people with serious ailments like cancer, HIV and AIDS, glaucoma, PTSD, seizures. And so you do have private studies and other countries that have done studies that show that marijuana can be effective for these things. But until our government lets that research happen, you know, it's always going to be this kind of anecdotal thing where the patients are saying, hey, this works. And I just want to say really quickly that when I first started this job in 2011, I was skeptical, and I really didn't know if marijuana had any medical benefits. But in the last 5 years, there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, you can talk to patients all over the country that swear by this. They say this helps me more than anything else, and I believe it. I really do.
We're speaking with Chris Walsh, who is managing editor of Marijuana Business Daily, and they have just released a special report giving out some information about this rapidly growing industry. Your report has five key takeaways, and one of them is headlined, "The Investing Floodgates Are Breaking." So in other words, the whole landscape is changing very, very rapidly, and some of that stigma that you were talking about earlier seems to be giving way, which is allowing for maybe a wider array of persons and entities to think about investing in this industry.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. A couple of years ago, investors and professional business people in general were wary and hesitant to get involved in this industry for obvious reasons. I mean, when you say, hey, I'm going to invest in a marijuana company or start one, you know, people look at you kind of funny in a lot of states and wonder what the heck you're doing. But you've seen that rapidly, that situation rapidly change in the last couple of years. This is becoming a more mainstream, legitimate industry, and you are seeing an amazing array of people getting involved. Silicon Valley investors, Wall Street bankers, former government officials, whether congressmen or the former governor of New Mexico became the CEO of a cannabis company. And then you have former DEA agents, former IRS agents get involved. So you're really seeing that stigma is starting to vanish in certain parts of the country.
The second takeaway is quite a surprise because, of course, this is a very, very new industry. And yet, apparently, it has grown so rapidly that we're already starting to see kind of that shakeout of winners and losers, with certain big players crowding out other smaller players who, for whatever reason, are having more limited success. It sounds like that is something that is a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, this industry is starting to follow the trend arc in any industry. And, you know, in the beginning, it's kind of boom time when a state legalizes medical or recreational. If you can open your doors, in a lot of cases, you're going to see business and lines out the door. Once that wears off, and it becomes a more traditional market, and it matures, you find the same issues come into play as in any industry. There's heavier competition, and you have to focus more on that and kind of surviving and thriving in the long term. So, yes, in some markets there has been consolidation. There's been a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and there's been business failures, too, that companies that just couldn't survive in a more competitive environment.
The third takeaway involves skyrocketing demand for concentrates and edibles. I have to confess to not really understanding what those terms exactly mean.
No problem. A marijuana edible is, think of the traditional marijuana cookie or brownie, you know, that everyone has heard about or experienced themselves when they were younger. That's basically, infused products can be anything from marijuana-infused cookies, brownies, gummy bears, sodas, oils, lotions. That's kind of the infused products area. There are patches and pills, and you name it. I mean, the industry has really innovated the delivery methods for marijuana in the last couple of years. And then concentrates are, as the name implies, highly concentrated forms of marijuana that get you high or bring pain relief a lot quicker and a lot higher doses. Think of it as like the Everclear of marijuana. You know, Everclear is the alcohol with very, you know, it's very, very potent.
Right.
So this segment has become very popular with elderly people who don't want to smoke marijuana. You know, you can take a gummy bear or you can take it in a pill form. It's popular with recreational customers who don't want to smoke either, and patients who use it for medical reasons. So that part of the industry is growing very, very rapidly.
It sounds like with this growth, according to the fourth takeaway, one of the consequences is that the costs involved in getting a license and so on are also rising. That probably should not be a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, a couple years ago, you could get started in this industry, you know, for $10,000, $20,000 in a lot of cases, because there were very light regulations in most states. What you've seen in the past 4 or 5 years is that states have implemented very strict regulations. In almost every state now, you have to obtain a license. Sometimes it's very competitive. Sometimes there's a cap on the number of licenses, and sometimes it's open-ended. But regardless, you have to pay for, you know, application fees, and you usually have to get consultants and help to help you draft a business plan and submit all the necessary documents to a state. And then you have to renew your license, and then you have to meet all these security requirements, and the list goes on and on. So it's become a lot more expensive to actually start a company in this industry than it ever was.
Right. And your fifth takeaway is that for as certain as we can be that this is likely to continue to increase, it is also a very uncertain time in terms of various states operating in different ways, some of them enacting regulations and so on. It's a tricky time to become part of this industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been tricky. In 2011, there was a wave of crackdowns, and hundreds of dispensaries were forced to close because district attorneys were targeting the industry. And then you have, you know, huge banking problems. I mean, there's always something this industry's facing. So it's always been tricky. Now is probably a better time than ever to get involved, because it's clear that the federal government isn't going to throw people in jail who are operating businesses under a statewide framework. However, you know, it's still, as you mentioned, it's still tricky. The regulatory landscape changes monthly, it seems, in a lot of states. States are often going back and revising and tweaking regulations, introducing new ones, you know, changing the fees and all that. So there's a lot of volatility for right now, and it's going to be like that for years.
Well, it underscores the importance of getting good information, and some of that information is available through this new annual report and through the persistent reporting of Marijuana Business Daily. Chris Walsh, its managing editor. Chris Walsh, how can people contact you and or Marijuana Business Daily to get more information?
Visit our website at mjbizdaily.com, and you can get all the important news that affects the business and learn more about the industry. And we have links there to our market research reports and our big business-to-business conferences, where we get a lot of seasoned people that run businesses, but we get a lot of newbies who are saying, what's this industry about? I kind of want to learn about it, maybe get involved.
Very good. Chris Walsh, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has been interesting.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
The time is 8:28. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Dr. Michael Bennett, who has education from both Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, a board-certified psychiatrist. He is Canadian, also a Boston Red Sox fan, his biography tells us, and has worked in primary practice for many, many years, for several decades, in fact, and has co-written a book with his daughter, Sarah Bennett, that is meant to be a very helpful and sometimes rather hard-hitting examination of the kind of problems which people tend to have, and how sometimes we kind of create our own problems because of our own mistaken assumptions about what life is supposed to be. and we end up chasing after dreams that just aren't worth chasing, and end up trying to get at the root of problems or find the answers to questions that maybe do not exist. That is, the questions exist, but maybe no answer. I mean, we can so often find ourselves kind of endlessly chasing our tails in pursuit of some kind of happier life. That's certainly the contention of both Dr. Michael Bennett and his daughter, Sarah Bennett, in their new book. And I have to proceed cautiously and squeamishly here, because the title of the book is basically F Feelings, if you know what I mean. That four-letter word is right on the cover of the book. It adorns every chapter of the book as well. So they pull no punches in trying to state in the most down-to-earth language possible their hope of sort of shaking us loose from some of the assumptions we make about what it means to have a happy, fulfilled life. So the title of the book is F Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Dr. Michael Bennett, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's get this little, let's call it the white elephant in the room. Let's get it out of the way. Is there any particular reason that you and your daughter have adapted kind of the linguistic flavor that you have, not only with the title of the book, but in a lot of what's within the covers of the book? Is there a purpose in that?
Well, we've asked ourselves that, too. And no, we don't spend all our time swearing. We're looking for shock and humor, particularly humor. And my experience with patients was when you reach the right moment and you're shy, you know, nobody expects a nice psychiatrist to use bad language, and certainly not about feelings or love or parenting or all the sacred things that we assume are very important and acceptable goals. But it's a great way, using obscenity is a great way not to put people down, but to get them to think and laugh about what's really important and also what they have to accept about life. There are a lot of things which are really, you don't control them. They're awful and they cause pain and you can't stop the pain until it just goes away. And using obscenity to sort of cuss your way through it, accept it, and start to think creatively about what you can do with it, well, obscenity helps.
Right.
I had just graduated from Harvard with my degree in English, and I was off to medical school, and I had a chance to work. I had to work, as a matter of fact, as a trucker for a little while. And the guys taught me how to swear as a way to make the day go by a lot quicker and a way of getting along better with other people who were, lifting heavy things alongside you. And I got a sense that swearing can be a real positive language if used properly.
You know, as you were just speaking, it occurred to me for the first time that I think most of the time when we talk about shock value, we are really speaking typically very dismissively of something, that, oh, that was a great movie, except it had all this bad language, which just seemed to be there for shock value, as though there's no value in shock value. And probably a case could be made that a lot of good art is maybe needlessly riddled with that, and the shock value is really for no purpose whatsoever. You're talking about shock value really having some value in the case that you're talking about, that sometimes it makes sense in the hope of shaking somebody loose from the attitudes to which they're just sort of glued. Sometimes it probably takes a little shock to maybe get them to radically rethink lifelong habits of thinking, for instance.
Exactly. My daughter, Sarah, who's a comedy writer, would probably chime in that good comedy, good shock, gets you to think positively about life and face pain. Bad comedy just puts people down. That you have to walk a line and be careful. You're not just trying to get a reaction because you want to put somebody down. It could misfire. But when it works, and I think good comedians are very good at this, it really helps you to think about life in a more constructive way.
So what ends up happening in your book is you take aim at really 10 different facets of human life that we tend to think of as building blocks for a happy and healthy life. And you're not exactly telling people to discard these things altogether, but in many cases, telling them to be careful about these things and to not think about them in the wrong way. Because when we're talking about things like fairness and love and self-esteem and serenity, I don't think you and your daughter are making the case that there is no place at all for those sort of principles or practices in one's life, but that so often we end up using them in ways that can be very counterproductive. Is that a good way to summarize what you're trying to do here?
That puts it very well. We value all those things, but we also think there's a huge element about each one of them that you don't control. And if you don't control it and you really try to get it anyway, you know, most things that make us happy are not good for us. And when we try too hard to be happy and we can't, we usually make things worse. So we're saying all those are nice things and we want them as much as the next guy, but that life sometimes just doesn't give you those things, and you have to suck it up then and maybe accept that it isn't there. For people who just haven't had the good luck to find a good partner, or they have the bad luck to have somebody in their life who's really a jerk, and that isn't going to change. How you suck it up and take great pride in going ahead anyway. That it's a much harder task to deal with those things when you can't communicate or you've got a kid who is not doing well in spite of very good parenting. And take pride in you're enduring it. It's still trying to be a good person and still trying to do a good job with them.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Bennett, and we are talking about the book that he and his daughter, Sarah Bennett, have co-written. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and the title is F**CK Feelings. F Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems. I especially appreciate the first chapter of the book, which is devoted to self-improvement. And I've actually interviewed a couple of authors already who have kind of written on the same topic, namely what seems to be our insatiable fascination with and preoccupation with the notion of self-improvement. And I think you are trying to tell us that this can turn into something really frantic and self-defeating if we aren't careful. At what point does the quest for self-improvement become something that tends to be, in a sense, more self-destructive? I mean, is it right from the start, the moment we have the notion of improving ourselves, or at some point in the process does it become twisted? And what is that point?
Well, I'd say both. If you start it with the goal of self-improvement and you don't know how much you can improve or how much you can't improve, you've already given yourself an impossible goal. We all wish we could improve, but starting out with the goal to try to improve, to see how much you can improve, that's the same goal. Unfortunately, what we do instead is start out by getting fixated and saying, I can do it. I'm going to do it no matter what. And that's when, right from the beginning, we're pushing ourselves into something that's almost certainly going to become impossible in the end. And then, as you say, along the way, if you encounter a lot of difficulty and you've given it a good try, what you want to be able to do is to say to yourself, I've discovered something I can't do. Now, how am I going to work around that? Instead of, I've failed. I should be able to improve myself, and I can't. I'm a loser. So anywhere from the beginning to the middle to the end, any time you take a step back and start to look at it realistically, you've got a chance of dealing with it much better.
I was especially intrigued by the moment in this chapter when you talk about our love of trying to get at the root of some problem, with the goal of eradicating that problem from our lives and getting on to the matter of self-improvement. And it's at this point that you say there are lots of problems we'll never know the answer to. And, of course, there's a lot of people writing books that say exactly the opposite, who say, oh, yes, there's an answer out there, and here it is, and it's lucky that you're reading my wise words about how to find the answer to this particular problem. And you're really trying to shake us loose from that notion.
Well, I'm passing on the wisdom I've received from many people who have problems with alcohol or other drugs or other bad habits, who've learned that when you try too hard to find out the reason for things, you're really just postponing acceptance. That finding out why is, you know, if you were going to joke about it in a 12-step meeting, it would be why sounds very much like wine. You go on and on, but what you really have to do is to say, I don't know why I'm like this. I just have to stop. And the people do much better. You know, if you're going to find out why, it's worth trying once, twice, three times. But when you're really getting nowhere, you have to shut it down or you'll never accept that you've got a problem you've got to deal with, and you've got to deal with it without knowing why it's there.
We should mention at this point, because I don't think we've said it, is that every chapter of the book, and actually in more than one place in each chapter, there are these points called quick diagnosis, in which you really kind of take it down to a very, very sort of practical level. Explain to our listeners what happens at these points in the book with the moment of quick diagnosis.
Well, I think the major point of quick diagnosis is that when people accept things, common sense takes over, and there is a list of things that can help you to realize what your experience is telling you. My daughter, Sarah, could say it much better because she's so good at using humor to capture those moments. But she's got it right. And when you can capture that with somebody and essentially they realize they knew it all along.
Right.
And they're well on their way.
So typically in these quick diagnoses, it starts with, here's what you wish for and can't have. So in this case, in the self-improvement chapter, a clear understanding of what's wrong, complete control over your problem, an easier way of dealing with your problem now that you know its origins, a reliable way of treating and preventing it. I mean, those are the things that are proving elusive. And then, here's what you can aim for and actually achieve. Know as much as anyone knows about a problem while accepting your inability to know more. Accept the pain and confusion of having to deal with a problem you don't understand. Find deep motivation for not letting a problem change your priorities or values. Not let confusion or humiliation interfere with your determination to management. And then, here's how you can do it, in terms of some real specifics to try to get at that. And again, with various principles and practices, there is this approach which occurs. In the second chapter, you talk about self-esteem and the way in which this can so easily get out of hand, especially in something which you call ESE, excessive self-esteem, the scourge of excessive self-esteem. Describe to our listeners, although I think a lot of self-listeners probably can imagine what you're trying to say here, but what are you saying about excessive self-esteem?
We're saying there are some people who have much too much self-esteem. They can't see what they're doing wrong. They always think that what they're doing is great. They're having no problem. And, of course, in the process, they wind up hurting or ignoring other people. They feel fine. So that all those other people who second-guess themselves and worry about themselves or are shy or rarely feel on top of things, years and years of therapy is not necessarily going to change that, but that uncertainty and second-guessing often help you to be a better person. It just doesn't feel very good.
One of the things that is really interesting to me is how you and your daughter, let's say, have the guts to go after things that I think a lot of people at a glance would just think are unassailable essentials for human life. That, for instance, fairness. I mean, chapter 3 is titled F Fairness. And and of course, you're not saying that fairness has no place in human society, but I think you're saying that fairness is something that we should not expect to an unreasonable extent. Is that what we're kind of talking about? Accepting, at least to some extent, that life sometimes is and simply must be what sort of feels like unfair.
You said it. It's partly knowing that or accepting the fact that you can't make it fair. And if you try to be a Wyatt Earp and impose fairness on a situation when it's really not in your power, you'll just get yourself in trouble with everybody. And also that there's a passion for things to be fair. You know, a lot of road rage comes about because somebody does something very unfair as a driver and somebody else feels they have to punish them. We have an incredible passion to try to straighten things out. And more often than not, it can cause trouble. So I really tell people, or we do, the obvious, that they need to think through whether there's any chance of making things better or whether you just have to swallow it and try to move on and make things fair in the only way you do control, which is by being a good person.
I really am glad that you wrote chapter 4 on the dangerousness of the danger of helpfulness. That is our drive to be helpful to others is something that can so easily be twisted. I really hadn't even stopped to think about this in some of the ways that you explore. In particular, the way in which what feels in the moment like being helpful to others is really just a disguised excuse to change other people into what we think they should be. And we want to help them along that path of improvement. Where do you think that instinct comes from for our sense of being helpful to others sort of crossing that particular line?
Your guess is as good as mine. I would think the evolutionary biologist would say, because under a lot of circumstances, it helps us band together and survive. There are many times it helps, but it's a powerful instinct. Once it takes over, it has a life of its own. So even when the way you want to help somebody is clearly right, you want to save them from severe drug addiction, or you want to pull them out of a very destructive relationship, you can often do more harm than good if you don't ask yourself, hey, what's happening here? Am I doing any good? Am I getting through? And then taking a break. And if you aren't, saying, well, I did my best, and I will continue to do my best. But clearly, this problem is not going to respond right away, and I've got to let it be.
You write at one point, helping indiscriminately, reacting reflexively instead of thoughtfully, does harm when it's misdirected, misappropriates resources, and raises risks. Yes, it's noble to make sacrifices for the sake of others, but not when the chances of benefit are low and the cost and risk are high. Many helpers by nature are not interested in doing cost-benefit analyses. They live to help and despise risk-benefit managers as cold-hearted, selfish, and timid. I mean, you're really speaking about a couple of very different ways to view the world. And I think part of the point of this chapter is that you would encourage even those who really, at their core, want to be helpful to others for whatever reason, to just try to do so more carefully, not only for their own sake, but for the sake of those people they're trying to help.
You said it. It's very much an occupational hazard for shrinks and doctors and nurses and social workers. We're in this business because we really like to help. And because of that, we have to be very, very careful to draw that line or we become destructive.
You also take this into the arena of giving, saying at one point, unbridled giving may feel good, but good people need to make tough, less satisfying decisions about giving that take into account their own needs, resources, other obligations, and the risk of doing harm with their gifts. Good giving is equally selfish and selfless, and is measured not by sacrifice or the pleasure it brings, but the objective effectiveness of your gift. That will be sort of, that'll feel like cold water being poured on the passion of someone who wants to do good in the world. But you ultimately think all of us would be better off if we did our giving, in a sense, a bit more soberly.
I remember once as a medical student having an opportunity to go around with a general practitioner in England. And I saw a parent who was over-focused on a disabled child, and she was giving everything to that child and ignoring her other children, her husband, and herself. And it impressed deeply on me the dangers of the giving instinct when it isn't restrained by higher values. If this woman could have pulled back and gotten thought harder about what it means to be a parent and trying to make the best of things and how your resources are limited and you have to decide how to divvy them up and how it'll work, which child can use a resource and which child can't. It's a much less comfortable kind of feeling. It's a much tougher job. It doesn't leave you with good feelings, but it is, that's how you really need to do the job.
We should say that your chapter, your book goes into other chapters on things like love and communication. And of course, those are an important part of human life, but also can lead to terrible hurt and terrible damage to oneself and others. And in your very intriguing chapter about parenthood, I think one of the most interesting points you make is that we really have to be careful not to worship parenthood itself. And I got to say, I don't happen to be a parent myself, but I think I've seen that in a few parents in my life, where parenthood itself becomes something almost larger than life itself, and sometimes to the detriment of both the parents and their own children, whom they're so desperate to parent to the best of their abilities.
Yes, our tendency is to feel very responsible for what our kids are like, how they turn out, how happy they are, how well they're doing. And as a child psychiatrist, I've been impressed with the many things parents have no control over. One kid will be in a lot of trouble and another won't be. Kids have very, very different temperaments, very different vulnerabilities. And a big part of parenting is acknowledging when you've done your best and letting it be, remembering there are other things in life and that if you overdevote or over-criticize yourself for how one troubled kid is doing, it makes you less effective at helping them and less effective at living your life and taking credit for being a reasonably good parent.
Ultimately, leave it at the matter of treatment and the fact that we tend to think of treatment of so many of the ills that we suffer from as, and when we're talking about kind of mental or emotional difficulties, as kind of a magical, mysterious sort of thing. And you really call us away from that assumption and to think about the whole notion of treatment in a sense in much more pragmatic fashion.
Well, I think there's a broader movement in medicine as a whole. You know, our instinct is to say wherever there is suffering, there is a need for treatment. But in a rational way, well, we know that most serious ailments that are, you know, ongoing are not curable, and that treatments often have either a limited response or none. So that it's really very important for us to try things, but also to be ready to say more of this thing isn't going to help me. I just need to live my life and tolerate my symptoms. People are doing that more with medical problems, and the exciting finding is that when they have that kind of painful discussion, they often use less treatment but have better lives. I think that's true for psychotherapy, that we can get something from it sometimes, but that we always have to ask ourselves, when have I gotten what I can get? And I just have to do the best with things now. Or maybe I need some periodic coaching and support to keep my negative thoughts under control. But how often do I really need that? I think that just gets you into feeling more that you're controlling your life, even if your, you know, even if your painful problems can't be solved.
Hmm. The book is really intriguing, and I want to mention also in the acknowledgments something you say at the end of your particular list of thank yous. You say, "I thank my patients, who by and large give me the benefit of the doubt when I seem offensive, and take it on faith that my intentions are good." You go on to say, although we have taken great pains to remove any and all specific personal information, that is, in the accounts that you share from some of your patients and their experiences, the spirit and energy from their part of our conversations is what makes this book a dialogue. The book, again, is F blank 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 Feelings, One Shrink's Practical Advice for Managing All Life's Impossible Problems, written by Dr. Michael Bennett and his daughter Sarah Bennett, published by Simon & Schuster. Dr. Bennett, I have enjoyed this, and I enjoyed your book, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Well, I appreciate it and enjoyed it too, and thank you very much.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD, and we're going to talk through some of the interesting morning shows that are coming up next week. Beginning on Monday, when I share with you an interview that actually I'm recording later this morning with Sarah Silverman, who is the author of a new book called Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful Broken World. Rabbi Silverman and her husband have had the experience not only of raising several daughters, but also of adopting two boys from overseas, both of them from Ethiopia. And she writes with disarming honesty about that experience. So we'll hear from the author of Casting Lots on Monday's program. On Tuesday, I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center. He, of course, joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events, and he'll be with us on Tuesday. On Wednesday, you'll hear my interview with Kevin Elko. He is a sports psychologist who has worked with a number of different professional athletes and NFL teams. The book which he had a hand in creating is called The Sender, a story about when right words make all the difference. It springs from a real-life experience in which he sent a series of letters to an NFL coach as that coach underwent chemotherapy. And those letters are actually excerpted, are quoted in this really poignant book called The Sender. On Thursday, the author of Every Woman's Guide to Equality, she calls for women to honestly examine their lives